Our two-hour special on religion continues with a look at the complex spiritual history of the United States. Politicians love to compare America to the city on a hill that Jesus envisioned in the Gospel of Matthew. The image has been invoked by Puritans and presidents alike. Religious conservatives cite it as proof the founding fathers created America as a Christian nation. But historian Peter Manso argues that America has been critically shaped and informed by internal religious diversity from the start. Thomas Jefferson's critics called him an atheist. A Jewish merchant helped finance the Revolution. And Maryland was one of the rare places Catholics and Protestants coexisted. Sort of. One Nation Under Gods with Peter Manso. After the news from NPR. And welcome back to Midday, everyone, our second hour. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us as we continue our two-hour show on religion today. Did you know that his political opponents regarded Thomas Jefferson as an atheist? That they opposed the sale of his book collection to the government because it contained works about non-Christian religions? But Jefferson's collection ultimately became the core of the Library of Congress. And our next guest, Peter Manso, sees this as just one of many reasons to dispute the notion that the U.S. was founded specifically as a Christian nation. In fact, even the phrase, "In God We Trust," didn't become our national motto until when? When do you think? Until 1956, a Cold War reaction to the threat of godless communism. In a new book called One Nation Under Gods, plural gods, Peter Manso argues that too many Americans have learned about our religious history from what he calls the middle, rather than from the margins, where so much of our culture has been formed. For example, politicians of all stripes enjoy referring to America as the city on a hill. In fact, they're borrowing a line that John Winthrop borrowed from Matthew in the Gospel to describe a Massachusetts Bay colony that would expel anyone who deviated from Puritan orthodoxy. The reality, he says, is that Christianity, West African animism, Judaism, Buddhism, Sikhism, Shintoism, Catholicism, Islam, Mormonism, and an array of Native American beliefs have conflicted violently and coexisted peacefully at different times to form our religious and cultural history. Maryland was the first colony that allowed all Protestants and Catholics to practice their faiths, although most of the population in colonial America didn't bother to attend church. Early plantation owners denied Christianity to African slaves lest they be considered human beings. A quarter of those slaves were actually Muslim. A Jewish merchant provided critical financing for the Revolutionary War. Peter Manso even argues that Mormon founder Joseph Smith was influenced not so much by Protestant revivalism in New York as by the prophecies of an Iroquois spiritual leader named Handsome Lake. And the phrase, as I said, "In God We Trust," didn't become our national motto until 1956, a Cold War reaction to the threat of godless communism. If all this doesn't make America's religious background a melting pot, Peter Manso says, at least it's a salad bowl. Peter Manso is a historian. He lives here in Maryland, author of a prize-winning novel entitled Songs for the Butcher's Daughter, as well as a travelogue titled Rag and Bone, which looks at the world's religions through their relics. With Jeff Charlotte, he wrote Killing the Buddha, a Heretic's Bible, and he's the founder of killingthebuddha.com, a blog by and for religious iconoclasts. Peter Manso received his doctorate in religion from Georgetown, is currently curating an exhibit on America's religious past for the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. That's pretty cool. His new book is One Nation Under God from Little Brown. One Nation Under Gods. I got to make sure I use the plural there. A New American History. Nice to have you on the show, Peter. Welcome to the show.
It's great to be here, Dan. Thank you.
What made you want to put this together? Because, you know, a lot of us believe there's plenty of pluralism out there all through our history. Isn't that true? But no, you say the primary narrative has been, or the myth really, has been that we were founded as a Christian nation. So you wanted to dispel the myth once and for all?
When I began this book about 5 years ago, it seemed that we were really reaching a high point of this conflict between those who were arguing that the United States had been founded as a Christian nation and those arguing that, no, in fact, Jefferson and his ilk were enlightened deists and weren't Christians at all. And a lot of this controversy, the conflict between these parties, tended to rest on dueling quotations. The Founding Fathers wrote so much, you can find anyone saying a number of things to support your case. Right. And to me, this debate really missed a much more interesting way of talking about American religious diversity. It is not a simple question of yes or no, what did the founders intend? Because, of course, even from the beginning and before the beginning, the country was much larger than what the founders intended. There was religious diversity all around the Founding Fathers that they may not have even been aware of, as there had been for the centuries preceding the founding of the Republic. And so what I wanted to do with One Nation Under God's was not so much have a polemic, an argument against the notion that we are founded as a Christian nation, but rather a narrative of the full 500-year history of the American experiment that shows how much more interesting it really was.
Slaves, for instance. Why do you mind me starting there? This is very interesting to me. I know historians have noted that a number of the slaves that came to this country were Muslim, but they weren't allowed to practice their religion, right?
That's right. And I think that it's easy to forget that the men and women who were brought here as slaves had their own fully developed religious worldviews before they arrived. Because of the eventual birth of what is commonly known as the Black Church, varieties of African-American Christianity that grows out of and is influenced by the slave experience, we forget that only a vanishingly small fraction of enslaved Africans when they arrived in North America were Christians. Vanishingly small, practically non-existent. What they brought with them were a variety of African traditions, today known as Yoruba, Akan, Obeya. That's making up the majority of that population. And from about 25% to 30% of them were actually Muslims. So when they arrived, they were not allowed to practice their faiths. And yet at the same time, they were, in the early days of slavery, it was not encouraged that they would be converted because there was the very real question, based on a number of colonial laws, that might give freedom to someone based on their conversion to Christianity. So in colonial America, those laws needed to be rewritten before slaves could be converted. And after that, it was decided that conversion to Christianity might become a mechanism of control. It was widely believed by a number of people who began to advocate for this that to bring Christianity to a slave plantation was to find another way to control those who were enslaved on it.
You know, people have this conventional idea of religion, right? They think of it as organized. They don't. They may use the word spiritual or spirit, but primarily they think of an organized religion as a church, as actually a physical building where people sit and pray and worship. Usually a Christian idea too, a Christian image. But you delve into things that people don't always accept as organized religion, spiritualism, for instance, in the United States in the early part of the country.
Well, that was really one of what was considered most dangerous about the religions brought by the enslaved, for example. From a very early point, religious traditions, African religious traditions, were associated with slave revolts. For example, we heard very recently after the tragedy in Charleston about the slave revolt led by Denmark Vesey in 1822 at the
Emmanuel AME Church.
Yes, a founder of the Emmanuel AME Church, Denmark Vesey was a slave. He led a slave revolt in 1822. At the time of that revolt, as interesting to the press, to those writing about the slave revolt, not only was that it was church-based, but that it was led also by an African conjurer. That's what they were known at the time. But this was someone who was adept at the traditions that he brought with him. And this was problematic. It was a spiritual force that could not be controlled. And you find this throughout American history, not only with that particular slave revolt, but I in the book I write about it also in Massachusetts, the Puritan city on the hill. Here we have the story of a figure like Cotton Mather, whose family was the preeminent Puritan preaching family in Massachusetts. And he happens to have an African slave from whom he learns to become a bit more broad-minded, religiously speaking. It's a fascinating moment in American history when Cotton Mather and his fellow Puritans in Massachusetts were facing a smallpox epidemic early in the 18th century. And according to the prevailing religious view of the day, you could do nothing about something like this except pray about it to find out what sin you had committed to bring this upon the community and then to atone for it. But it so happened that Cotton Mather was in some ways a broad-minded man, and he learned from his African-born slave that in his youth he had been inoculated through what had been a ritual that was a combination of religious practice and medical practice. And this suggested to Cotton Mather this might be something that could be done in Massachusetts as well. So you have this fascinating moment when throughout the colonies, African traditions are considered a great risk, a great threat to society. And yet when one person decided he might be open to learning something from it, it really began to change the society.
That's a fascinating story. Also, John Winthrop, we'll throw him in here, another Puritan, leader of the Puritan colony there. And that phrase, shining city on a hill, or the city on a hill, it's been used in different ways over the years. It comes from Sermon on the Mount. It's from Matthew, quoting Jesus. Let's see, the quote I have, Matthew 5:14, Jesus tells his listeners, "You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden." And then we get to Ronald Reagan in 1984, and then Mario Cuomo using it in his speech at the Democratic National Convention, turning it upside down from how Reagan had posed it. I think Reagan posed it as a sort of touchstone of American exceptionalism, I would say, wouldn't you? Reagan wasn't using it in the religious context anymore.
That's right. It's a fascinating transformation of this phrase throughout American history. When John Winthrop used it, speaking to his colonists aboard his ship, the Arabella, he was telling them more or less, if you are a city on the hill, everyone's going to see you. Everyone from all around the hill is going to see you, and they're going to see if you don't measure up to your own ideals. If you fall short, if you fall into sin, the world will know that this has happened to us. But as the city on the hill moves through American history, it's taken up first in the 20th century by John F. Kennedy, who, as he's beginning his run for the presidency, says that, "I come from this city on the hill, and this is what our nation should become." Reagan repeats it again, first in 1976, when he's really beginning his national political career, and then throughout his presidency, again and again, the city on the hill. And the fascinating thing is that what happens is it's not a warning the way Winthrop meant it. It becomes a bastion. It becomes a fortress on a hill, nearly. And that changes the meaning dramatically, but that is what that development over time has led to. But the interesting thing about even when Winthrop used it originally is that here he is speaking to what he assumed was an entirely theological, homogenous society. And yet as soon as they landed, there were a variety of theological disagreements. There were great heresies moving throughout the colony. They began to evict people very quickly. Anne Hutchinson, very famously, was a midwife in Massachusetts who spoke to the women of the community and suggested an alternate way of being religious in the world. She was evicted from Massachusetts for that crime, as was Roger Williams, who went on to found Rhode Island with a more broad-minded religious view. So even at the moment the city on the hill was spoken of, it was already many cities on many hills.
A follow-up question there before our first break, Peter. So city on the hill, the way John F. Kennedy used it, the way Ronald Reagan used it, by the time they're using it, other than from among the religious or people who actually have paid attention to the Bible, does anyone recognize it as a religious statement? I mean, is Kennedy saying, you know, we're this Christian ideal? Reagan's not implying that, is he?
I think that's the subtext of it. I think it's a suggestion that that this is where we come from. This is our heritage, is a suggestion that many politicians make. It used to be very plainly stated as this is our Christian heritage, and more often people would say now that this is our Judeo-Christian heritage. And the point I make throughout the book is that even as broad as Judeo-Christian is as a term, it's much more complicated, much more diverse than that.
As for this being a distinctly Christian nation, founded as a distinctly Christian nation, Ted Cruz, one of the many Republican candidates for president, has made that statement recently, and religious conservatives continue to believe that. We're going to take a break here and come back and talk some more with Peter Manceau, a very unique religious history of the United States called One Nation Under Gods. Make sure we say plural there. A New American History. It's published by Little Brown. If you have questions, we'll continue our conversation with Peter in just a moment. 410-662-8780. Toll-free long distance for the Midday Show in Baltimore is 866-661-9309. And we have email, too, where we can take questions for our guest, midday@wypr.org. One Nation Under Gods, by our guest Peter Manceau, describes in fascinating detail many stories behind America's religious pluralism with a wonderful eye for the characters who inhabit that world. He just was talking about the Puritan Cotton Mather. Later on in this hour, John Starr Cook, we should talk about him, the sort of all-purpose guru who inspired Timothy Leary and other prophets of LSD-based religious experiences in the 1960s. We can't leave out the witches, the witches of Salem, right? Because you didn't leave them out, Peter.
No. And the witches of Salem, to me, it's a fascinating story that we all know. We all know the details, whether through the Crucible, the play, or the movie. We all perhaps read it in high school. And so we know the broad strokes of the story of the witches of Salem. But when you really dig into what happened, it becomes not only this story of collective hysteria, which is what we usually assume that it is, it becomes this window onto early religious diversity in the English colonies. And what I mean by that is the controversy in Salem in 1692 is sparked, as many of us will remember, by several young girls falling ill with a mysterious malady, and it's considered that there must be some kind of spiritual cause for this. But behind that is this figure, a woman named Tituba. Tituba, who in popular memory is often remembered as kind of a African voodoo queen who's been brought to Sleepy Salem, Massachusetts. She was an enslaved woman, but she was more likely a woman of Caribbean heritage. And at the time, in fact, there was in Massachusetts, there was a desire to have as a labor force indigenous peoples as well as imported African labor force. But they found in Massachusetts that they could not control New England natives as well as they could those brought from elsewhere. So there was a traffic between New England and the Caribbean. And this West Indian woman was brought up, Tituba. And she brought with her a range of spiritual practices that she had learned in her young life. And among them was the divination. And so when these young girls were sick, she was asked by an English colonist to create something, to make something that was known as a witch cake, which was created by taking some cornmeal and various other grains, mixing it together with the urine of a dog and baking it, and then feeding it to the dog. And somehow this would tell you what kind of demonic forces were at work. And so it's often remembered or often suggested that there was nothing that even looked like witchcraft in Salem going on. But in fact, there was, not only by this woman Tituba, but by many of the colonists who likewise, who may have been Christian in name, had brought with them a number of European folkloric practices and were ready to use them. So the story of Salem is really, as much as it becomes a story of collective hysteria and overreaction, at its beginning, it is a story of the disruptive nature of religious diversity in a place like Salem.
Why in that story is it considered witchcraft? Is it considered evil?
Well, in fact, they called it themselves a witch cake. This is what they knew it as, and it was considered.
But who called it that? Did Tituba call it that?
We have the record of what the women who asked her to make it called it, so they knew it as a witch cake.
Okay. But that suggests something evil, correct? An evil religion, an evil spiritualism?
In the mindset of the Puritans, certainly it did. And this connected to all of this is this—we have to remember, the world they lived in. Just these very small settlements chinked out of an unimaginable wilderness. And to Puritans at the time, they associated everything beyond, so mostly Native American cultures which surrounded them, as being of the devil. They had no other vocabulary for talking about what it was. Mm-hmm. And so anything from beyond was of the devil. And so to them, the logical association with someone like Tituba creating something like a witch cake was that it was of the devil. And the truly fascinating thing about her role in this story is that when she is arrested, along with many other women in Salem and all throughout Massachusetts at the time, when she is arrested and brought to trial, she denies that she has done anything wrong. She was only trying to help the girls. She loved the girls. She wanted to take care of them. And so she did what she was asked to do by someone else. And she goes on with these denials for quite a while as she's being asked, how long have you known the devil? When did the devil come to you? And she's getting nowhere in her denials until she finally says, oh, the devil came to me last Tuesday, in fact. And we were in conversation about this for an ongoing period of time.
Uh-oh.
And this takes control of the narrative in such a way and so unsettles the people of Salem that Tituba, though she is ground zero in many ways of the crisis in Salem, is one of the very few who survives. She is not executed for the crime.
Peter Manso is our guest. One Nation Under Gods, his book, A New American History. We're sort of walking through history here a little bit. I'll stick with the 17th century for one more question. And this brings us south along the map of the New World to the Maryland colony. I thought it'd be interesting for our listeners here to hear about Jews and Muslims in the Catholic colony of Maryland and the Catholic colony itself. Very interesting arrangement that we had here between Catholics and Protestants.
Yeah. Maryland is really unique in that it was founded, some would say that it's founded specifically for the purpose of religious toleration, because though we have these other English colonies where people are going to worship and practice religion as they please, it was well known that in those colonies there was a hatred for Catholics, whether or not they were a colony was more associated with the Anglican Church or they were Puritans, later known as the Congregational Church. There was just a rabid hatred for Catholics and all that Catholics stood for. So it became apparent to the first Lord Baltimore, George Calvert, that there should be a place in the New World for Catholics to feel comfortable, and this was the genesis of Maryland. However, when they first arrived, the first group of Catholics in the 1630s, by this point, the first Lord Baltimore had died, and his son, the second Lord Baltimore, oversaw this early settlement of Catholics. He told them, you will have religious freedom here, but don't be too showy about it. You want to keep it under wraps, because they knew that though they were coming here, they would very soon be overtaken by Protestants, so keep it quiet. So that arrangement eventually led to the creation of known as the Maryland Act Concerning Religion, sometimes called the Toleration Act of 1649. And this made it put it on the books that you could be in Maryland and worship as you saw fit, but to a point. Toleration is always to a point. And so an interesting fact about the Maryland Toleration Act is that though it says anyone who worships God, who believes in Jesus Christ, is free to be here, it also says if you blaspheme God or doubt the Trinity or doubt Jesus Christ, you can be put to death.
And that gets us to Jacob Lombroso. I have it as Lumbrozo, right?
Yes.
He was a Jewish doctor.
He was, and he was probably the first Jew in Maryland. And he was enticed here as a doctor because the eastern shore of Maryland, one part of it, hoped to have a doctor to be on hand. And so he arrived here in the 1650s, and he fell into or he fell under the he became the first target, really, of this Toleration Act because he was out with some of his associates having a theological conversation. And eventually he began to be questioned about what he believed about Jesus Christ. And it seems like the people who were asking him were egging him on a bit, because the more he said, the more they wanted him to say. And he eventually suggested that, in his opinion, Jesus Christ must have been a magician. And that he was only able to perform miracles, and his disciples were later able to perform miracles by the passing on of some kind of dark magic arts.
Wow.
So he was arrested
for
this.
Wrong thing to say,
yes,
I would think.
Yeah. He was arrested for this and nearly was hanged for the crime of blasphemy in the 1650s.
And how did he get out of that? Do you know?
He was very lucky.
Here, I'm asking a historian if he knows. The guy just wrote a book about this. But this is 1650. I just wonder, how did Jacob escape the noose?
He was very lucky. There was, as in the colonies at the time, everything was existing as through the repercussions of what was happening in England. And so through the changing of the crown in England, the crowning of the new king created an amnesty at just the right time for him.
Oh, I see. So the timing worked out for Jacob.
He was very lucky.
And he survived. Did he continue to live in the Maryland colony?
Yes, he did. Yes, he did.
I want to ask you about someone else here. Ayuba Suleiman Diallo on Kent Island. This gets us into the 18th century. But this was one of the slaves, one of the Muslim slaves?
He is, in fact, the first Muslim slave whose individual story is known. There are references to Muslim slaves as a group earlier than that, but in the 1730s, when his story is told, he is the first individual Muslim slave whose story is known. And he was enslaved on Kent Island, and he escaped briefly and was recaptured, was brought to a jail and courthouse in Annapolis, where an Annapolis judge met him, had long conversations with him, and eventually wrote his story. Mm-hmm. And through the writing of his story, this man was eventually freed.
Back to Protestants and Catholics in the Maryland colony, just to wrap that up there, it didn't always work out so well at coexistence, did it?
No, it didn't. And it lasted, the idea of toleration, the idea that Maryland would be a safe haven for Catholics only lasted a number of decades. By the early part of the 18th century, I think it's 1704, there was an act passed to prevent the spread of popery, for example. And so there was, this is the world into
which... Excuse me, Peter, just stop there for a second. I missed this one. Stop the spread of popery? I'm all for that. I think there's way too much popery here in the 21st century. But what was that about?
Oh, it was about that it was thought that there were too many Catholics around and they were exerting too much influence.
Too much diversity.
Too much diversity.
Okay.
But it was within that environment that a number of truly prominent Maryland Catholics were born. Bishop John Carroll, who built the Basilica here, Elizabeth Ann Seton, who converted to Catholicism under his tutelage, including also a often forgotten figure named a Baltimore figure named Mother Mary Lang, who started the Oblate Sisters of Providence, who was the first African-American Catholic sister in the New World.
Let's see. I got some questions for you to follow up on what we've covered already. I welcome some more here on the Midday Show. If you have any questions for our guest, Peter Manso, One Nation Under Gods is his book, published by Little Brown, A New American History, 410-662-8780. This is from Kevin in Reservoir Hill. He said, Peter, I heard you mention the Puritans in the shaping of early American history and was curious as to the role of the Quakers in terms of religious tolerance and the role of religion in terms of shaping public policy. For example, how did religion shape abolitionism or feminism?
Well, the Quakers are another of these groups that needed to find their own space to practice freely, though New England was founded with this idea that some could practice freely, that meant that others could not. And so the Quakers gravitated down eventually to Pennsylvania. But interestingly, here in Maryland, those people who brought the charges against Jacob Lombroso happened to be Quakers. And so...
Really?
So you could find people who were terribly tormented and even hanged in New England. Quakers were put to death for being Quakers in Massachusetts. Though you find that once they move into another place, the rules change slightly.
Yeah, this is very interesting. We're talking about the ideal of the city on a hill, for instance, right? An ideal would be toleration, pluralism, all are welcome. It really didn't work out that way, did it?
Well, toleration is an interesting word. And in fact, George Washington wrote a very famous letter to the Jewish community of Newport, Rhode Island, in which he basically said that religion in America is not going to be about toleration, because toleration assumes that one group is in power and is allowing others
tolerating.
So toleration doesn't go far enough. To have true religious freedom, toleration is not it.
wanted to talk about Thomas Jefferson at this juncture because this is interesting. I got an email coming off of the previous hour of the show when we were talking about Islam. Arthur wrote in to say, I am so tired of hearing how misunderstood and persecuted religious people are. If you want to really know persecution, try being atheist in this hyper-religious world. Now, we're not saying Thomas Jefferson was an atheist. There are those who believe he was.
There are those who believe he was. But the interesting thing about that charge is that then as now, it's always politically charged. Atheism exists within contexts, within particular contexts. So before I get to Jefferson, I'll tell the story of someone just before Jefferson chronologically.
Okay.
This is a fellow named William Livingston, who was the first governor of New Jersey and a patriot in the Revolutionary War. But before that, when he was an angry young man in the 1750s, a Presbyterian living in New York State, he fought against Anglican establishment of a particular college that he was associated with. And in his fighting against it, he was labeled an atheist far and wide in the press. And at this point in American history, to be called an atheist was only a slur. It was only an insult you'd find just used to question whether someone had any morality at all. And the fascinating thing about this fellow William Livingston is that when he was called an atheist, he didn't deny it. He just sort of shrugged it off and said, well, if being an atheist means standing against this particular unjust rule of religion combined with government, then maybe I am an atheist. Because atheism, what your atheism is, it always depends on what your theism is. And if your theism, if the culture's idea of theism is associated with secular power, then standing against that secular power, in that case, the power of the crown, is going to be called atheism. Going back even further than that, Christians in the second century, for example, were called atheists. They were called atheists because they did not believe in the many gods of the Romans.
Right. So when we get to Jefferson, where is he? He was considered Christian? Did he go to church?
Well, he did go to church. In fact, I recently gave a talk down in Colonial Williamsburg. Williamsburg was the capital of the colony of Virginia during Jefferson's life. And at the time, you, for a man of Jefferson's station, you were required to be a member of the church. So I went and sat in his pew with his plaque on the side of it. So he was clearly a church member, and yet he was also a famous free thinker. He is famous for creating his own version of the New Testament.
He was a revolutionary.
He was, in more ways than one. And so his Jefferson's version of the New Testament, a book he concocted called The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth, often called the Jefferson Bible, he actually created by taking several copies, different translations of the Bible, and cutting out all the parts he didn't agree with, and then pasting together all of the parts that he did agree with, which was basically the Bible without the miracles. And that was the Jesus he believed in. That's the type of Christian he was. And it's that perspective that was reflected in his library that he had at Monticello, which following the burning of the Capitol in
1814,
at the end of the War of 1812, the Congressional Library collection was lost. And when Jefferson heard of this, he thought, well, this would be a good time to share my books,
right?
Or rather, to sell my books to the federal government.
But he sold it for a dollar or something like that, or was
he got a good deal.
Okay, I didn't remember the story. So sorry.
You know, he did get a good price for it, and that was part of the opposition to the sale was that here we are, we just finished a war. His opponents said we don't have the money to spend on books, but the other part of it was that many people said, here, Jefferson is a clear atheist. His books are full of all kinds of religious perspectives. We don't want these books infecting the federal government. And that was the language that they used. In fact, in the debates that went on in Congress at the time, it was actually suggested that they would be better off burning Jefferson's books than allowing them to become the core of the Library of Congress.
Wow.
And just in context, half the federal capital had just been burned to the ground, including
the
White House, including 3,000 books that had been the original Library of Congress. And so Jefferson's ideas were so dangerous at the time that it was suggested it'd be better off to burn them.
Wow. And what prevailed there? Who prevailed?
Jefferson prevailed, and it was really a matter of party politics. His party had enough support to make it happen.
And over the years, how was the Jeffersonian, the Jefferson Bible received?
Well, very recently it was shown at the National Museum of American History in Washington, and it was received rapturous
attention. How about back then when he published that? He did. Bible minus the miracles.
He knew it would be trouble. He didn't publish it in his lifetime, and so it was only discovered posthumously.
That was safe.
Yes, he would not have gone there. He knew that was a real problem.
I'm just amazed that Jefferson found time to do all these things. I'm just still amazed by him. Peter Manso is our guest here. Please give us a ring if you have a question for Peter about religion in America as we walk through this history. 410-662-8780. Again, Peter's book is One Nation Under Gods. We'll be right back. Hey, welcome back. We've been spending time talking about religion today. I hope you've enjoyed this, a religious history of the United States here. Peter, there's so many different stories. I mentioned in the book that there's a lot of characters in your book, and not just the founding fathers. We mentioned the first Jew in Maryland, Lambrusco. There's another Jewish figure in your book, Chaim Solomon, a Jewish merchant from Poland, who figures in the American story.
That's right. Chaim Solomon was a Jew living in Philadelphia, which at the time was really the capital of Jewish America during the Revolution. And Chaim Solomon was well known because he was a friend of many of the founding fathers, and more than a friend, he was a funder of many of them. He kept many of them solvent by making funds available for them. And as the story goes, he made his resources so readily available to the Patriots' cause that by the end of the war, he was owed $600,000 by the federal government, which he was never repaid, and he apparently just wrote off the debt.
Nice of him to do that. Yeah. I have a question about Jews coming to the new colony. Mm-hmm. That you were surprised to learn about this when you were doing your research?
I was surprised. It may be surprising to many readers because when one thinks of American Jewish culture now, we think mainly of what is known as Ashkenazic Jewish culture, which is Eastern European Jewish culture that grew out of 19th century immigration of Jews to America.
That's what most people probably think of.
But in the early part of American history, it was really the Jews from the Iberian Peninsula, from Spain and Portugal, who were those who first came, the Sephardic Jews. And many of them came not directly from Spain or Portugal, where centuries before they had been evicted from Spain. In the same year Columbus sailed the ocean blue, 1492, Jews were evicted from Catholic Spain. They came by way of Brazil often. And so there was a kind of a triangle between Amsterdam, which is another population center of Sephardic Jews, the new colonies in Brazil, and then the New World, most specifically the city then known as New Amsterdam, where they were not welcomed with open arm by New York Governor Peter Stuyvesant.
Jacob Lambrusco, who we mentioned earlier, the physician who was almost hanged in the Maryland colony, actually was a Portuguese Jew. Who had came here. And I don't know if we mentioned this, that he was able to live out his life here. And he only became a citizen, I think you say, several years after the Revolution. He was granted full citizenship in Maryland because he was Jewish. He was granted that by law, or granted that by the governor, or do you know?
Well, the likely end to his story is that he very likely converted, if not formally, then in name. And the interesting thing about that is that conversion in American history has often been for very practical purposes. And so one often finds that a primary religious identity is named, even if the faith nominally is changed. This is something that we see often throughout the history of we spoke briefly about Muslim slaves, for example. The most prominent, the most well-known slaves who practiced Islam when they arrived eventually converted to Christianity, perhaps in name alone, but not always. There's a fascinating story of a man named Omar ibn Said, who was a slave living in Fayetteville, North Carolina. And he wrote an Arabic language memoir of his life in the 1830s. And in it, he recounts that when he, before he was captured, he read the Quran every day. But now that he was here living among Christians, he learned to read the Bible. Hmm. And many many others who left similar accounts or were known in the press at the time make wonderfully telling comments such as that they have no problem with the Christian Bible. Their only problem with it is that Christians don't always follow it. And so this is a story of what conversion actually means in American history. Often it can be a true spiritual changing of the heart, but just as often it is a practical matter of getting through the world.
Our guest, Peter Manceau, is a historian and journalist who lives here in Maryland, lives in Annapolis. And I wanted to mention that you were stationed at Washington College for a time there as a fellow.
I was. I had at the time what is known as the Patrick Henry Writing Fellowship, which was given to me to work on this book. So this book was really born there in Chestertown.
What was the biggest eye-opener for you? I always like to ask historians about this because you assume a historian gets into a book, they pretty much know everything. They just need to confirm what they already know. But, you know, what did you discover in doing this? What was a surprise to you?
I was surprised by a chapter late in the book. I wanted to find a way to tell a story in which the story showing in which the ways in which religious pluralism had an effect on the home front in World War II. And so I ended up finding a story about the internment of Japanese Americans. What I did not know was that at the start of World War II, Japanese Buddhists were targeted by the FBI and under suspicion, similar to what Muslims might have felt after 9/11. Following Pearl Harbor, it was thought that Japanese Buddhists specifically had connections to the home country that made them dangerous. And so Japanese Buddhist priests were the first rounded up for internment. And many of those ultimately interned at the internment camps also continued to be practicing Buddhists. But the fascinating footnote to that is that many of the young men who were taken away from their homes with their families wanted to show their loyalty by enlisting in the army. And so many of them joined an army regiment called the 442nd, which became the most decorated combat regiment in the European theater during World War II. And as a consequence of this, and through the work of Japanese Buddhist veterans later on, the policies of the U.S. military were actually changed in terms of recognizing religious minorities. Before this, you could either be known as a Catholic, a Protestant, or a Jew. On a dog tag, you would have a C, a P, or an H for Hebrew. Everyone else was other. And so the Buddhist veterans first began pushing to get a Buddhist B and to have military cemeteries open themselves up for Buddhist symbols. And once they did that, the way was cleared for all other religious minorities as well.
Are you surprised that they were practicing Buddhists in the United States? Is that what surprised you about that story?
What surprised me was the way in which this pattern of suspicion of different religious worldviews continues and plays out again and again. Yeah. And of course, it's been everywhere over the last 14 years since September 11th. We've taken for granted that there's a large amount of suspicion targeted against Islam, as your previous guest described. But to see it play out again and again in American history was a surprise and a sobering one.
Now, you took a look at Joseph Smith here, the Mormon founder, Joseph Smith. Fascinating story, peeled away from, what would we call it, conventional mainstream Protestantism to this revivalist Protestantism, I guess we call it. And he's associated with New York State, right? But you found a connection between him and an Iroquois spiritual leader, who I mentioned earlier, Handsome Lake. I love this name. So tell us about that. That's the part of the Joseph Smith. I can't say I know the Joseph Smith story perfectly, but I don't remember this part, hearing about this part.
Well, Joseph Smith was a young man living in upstate New York.
Yeah.
And as his family would later retell it, he was obsessed with Indian lore, with Indian, with Native American legends, and with that culture. And he was also caught up in a moment known as the Second Great Awakening, a great flowering of religious devotion all around the United States. And it's been suggested by Mormon historians recently that in the process of developing his new religion, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, he was actually exposed to the work of a Native American prophet by the name of Handsome Lake. Now, Handsome Lake was was the brother of a well-known Iroquois leader named Cornplanter, and they lived on a reservation known as Cornplanter's Village. Handsome Lake, before his religious awakening, had been a sort of ne'er-do-well. He was a notorious drunk and would go off on these rampaging drinking binges. And as the result of one of these, he lay dying one day. And as he was dying, he saw three heavenly figures come to him and tell him to reform his life, and in so doing, he would help his people. He wrote down the revelation they gave him. Actually, he did not write it down. It was transmitted orally. It became known as the Code of Handsome Lake, and it was the basis of a Native American religious revival at the beginning of the 19th century. Well, there were basically evangelists of this off traveling around New York State, and the youthful Joseph Smith happens to, it is suggested by some historians, have come in contact with this shortly before he claimed to have discovered plates written on the ground from which he was able to translate the Book of Mormon. And what the Book of Mormon really is this epic negotiation between European religious culture and Native American religious culture. In a way, this had been the question that Europeans had been asking for centuries. When they arrived with their Christianity, with their religious understanding of the world, how do you make sense of this civilization that is not explained in your book that explains everything? And so you find throughout American history various figures trying to make sense of Native Americans, what they might mean. But no one went so far as Joseph Smith, who actually finds a way to write them into the biblical story.
You know, I mentioned John Starr Cook because I had to ask you about him, which brings us ahead 150 years or so to the time of Timothy Leary, the Summer of Love, and, you know, the idea that you take some LSD and have a religious experience. But that was a for real thing with this John Starr Cook, right?
John Starr Cook was a largely forgotten guru of the 60s, and he was among the first to discover LSD and to become a real apostle of its use for religious purposes. Yeah. But fascinatingly, he actually has, there is a Baltimore root to his story.
Really?
Because before he discovered LSD, his main religious tool that he used to direct his entire life was the Ouija board.
Which was invented here.
Which was invented right on Charles Street, in fact, at the end of the 19th century.
So that was before LSD for John Starr Cook.
It was.
He used the Ouija.
It was. But it was, in a way, a gateway drug for him. It eventually...
Don't get us started here. Hear that, ladies and gentlemen? Don't use the Ouija board. It could be a gateway to... Yeah.
But he followed the Ouija all around...
Mothers against Ouija. I can hear them now.
He followed the Ouija's advice all around the United States and eventually fell in with, of all people, L. Ron Hubbard, founder of Scientology, when Scientology was first becoming a religion. And he was briefly involved with them, and then from there he was down in Tangier, where he developed the use of various other chemical substances in his religious worldview. And then from there he went back. Long story short, he ended up in the vicinity of Haight-Ashbury and became the inspiration for people who put on things like the Human Being, the first hippie gathering in San Francisco, and eventually leading up to the strangest spiritual moment of the 60s, I think, the attempt by Abbie Hoffman to levitate the Pentagon in 1967.
All right. Thank you very much, Peter. Thanks for that memory. Amazing stuff. Peter Manso, historian, journalist who focuses on religion, writes a lot, including for the New York Times. One Nation Under Gods is his book, A New American History, published by Little Brown. I really enjoyed this conversation, Peter. Thank you very much for filling us in on all these great stories. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan.
Give us a lot to think about today. I hope you enjoyed today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Please come back again soon. Dan Roderick's here for our staff at midday. Have a great afternoon. See you again.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at wypr.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.